A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. Bonjour, ciao, hola. How about, get them in order? Oh, none of them are good, are they? I was saying hello to you, Thea, in a variety of European languages.
You were.
Ciao is how you say hello.
That is just how, well, and goodbye.
Yeah, that's weird. Is that weird?
Well, context, I don't know, is it?
Well, I don't know. You're never going to be confused, are you?
Well, I think also, exactly, and in Italy it would certainly be accompanied by some kind of gesture that would make the difference. You know, you'd figure it out. I don't think you'd be in any doubt as to...
Saying hello or goodbye!
Am I coming or going?
I don't know what to do. Alf News!
Oh, gosh, he was off the lead for the first time yesterday. It was a big moment. He came back. He was so stoked. He was thrilled.
Were you stoked?
I was stoked, especially when he came back.
Yeah, that's the big test.
Until then, I was very anxious.
Hurrah. This week is a European special of the TLS. We record this just a couple of days before Brexit Day, the 29th of March, a day commemorating independence from the bureaucratic botherers from Brussels. In one perspective, or a further turning inward of little England from another. Actually, the process has been such a farce from beginning to end that we're not actually leaving on Friday and we don't know what we're doing instead. So we thought, why not talk about art, culture and ideas instead? Coming up, David Robey will tell us about a writer from Italy, part of the canon there, who is not well known over here, Emilio Salgari.
Very good.
Thank you. Thea will be handling pronunciation on behalf of the whole team. You'll be pleased to hear. Say Salgari, Thea.
I would say it exactly as you did.
Yeah, no, you wouldn't, because you'd have that little exuberant flick, Salgari, wouldn't you?
Well, you just have to keep listening and then you'll find out.
You do say it, yeah. Richard Forty has been reading A Natural History of the Continent of Europe. So we're looking not only at modern political troubles, or not even at modern political troubles, we're going for the geological distance of some 65 million years. We'll see if that gives us some perspective. And we'll be talking to the TLS cartoonist Ella Barron, a rising star of the art world, who's done the cover this week and a cartoon inside. How does she do it? We will find out. Europe is always at a crossroads, says Richard Forty in this week's TLS. And like many commentators, he's talking geologically and geographically, not politically. Forty, who once wrote a splendid book called Life and an Authorised Biography, has reviewed a book by Tim Flannery called Europe, A Cultural History, which he describes as an energetic sprint through more than 65 million years of complex biological history. This is an account of a perpetual tectonic ballet, Africa's restless movement shifting and shaping the European continent. Flannery describes all this in some 350 pages. Richard Forty does it in some 2,000 words, and we'll try and do it justice in the next 15 minutes or so. Richard Forty's in the studio with us to make it all happen. Richard, hello.
Hello.
So, should we start 65 million years ago? Actually, do we need to go a bit further back? 175 million years ago, and this is the supercontinent Pangaea breaking up.
Yes, I guess if people were asked one geological fact they know, they would know that all the continents were once united together in one great supercontinent, Pangaea. The southern part of that often being known as Gondwana.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And that supercontinent broke up because of the appearance of the modern oceans. So the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean, well, particularly the Atlantic Ocean, started as a mere sliver, and then the Americas broke off, drifted. No, that's the wrong word. We used to talk about continental drift. It's a more active process than that, because as they drifted apart, the mid-ocean ridges created new ocean crust.
So there's it's much more dynamic a thing than
it's much more. Implies. Yeah, drifting implies you're a cork floating on the bath, doesn't it? But this is much more dynamic than that. And it's driven by the Earth engine, the business going inside the centre of the Earth.
And you call it, at one point, remorseless shoving of Africa. So this is the idea of sort of rumpling the carpet.
It's very much like that, because one of the consequences of this movement, it wasn't just a simple passive splitting apart, but was a northwards movement of Africa, which was influential over tens of millions of years. Ultimately, that pushed up what we now call the Alps. Yeah. Before that, there were pre-Alps. And the effects of that are spread all the way across the continent of Europe. And of course, animals and plants are, in a sense, tectonic passengers. So they're going to move at the behest of rising islands, sinking continents, and so on. So Flannery is rather good at weaving in the tale of the tectonics and what happens to organic evolution as a result of that.
And how are we supposed to think of this? Because I've read books which talk about these forces happening over tens of millions of years. Is it even possible to conceive of how that would be perceived by an animal living at any one point in that process? Is it sort of violent activity, or is it completely unseen activity? Is that knowable?
It's a very good question, of course, but I mean, the continuous motion is unseen, and you wouldn't feel it. You wouldn't say, goodness me, we've just moved another centimetre.
Yeah.
But, of course, where this sort of thing happens, you get tectonically active zones, so you get things like major earthquake zones. One block sliding past another. It's still happening in Turkey, of course.
Yeah.
And then you get ocean basins, which are at one time opened up and at other times closed. The Mediterranean was preceded by a vast ocean called the Tethys, even one before that, that snaked all the way across through Europe and over to the Far East, through the Himalayas, where the Himalayas is now, and eventually down into Southeast Asia.
That was so one big ocean.
It was one big ocean full of life. The organisms are at the mercy, really, of what's going on tectonically, but it happens very slowly, which gives things time to migrate and move in from one area to another. Flannery's previous books, as you probably know, were about Australia, which has been a thing unto itself for a long time.
Yeah, which is why it has such a sort of
distinct,
curious endemics, a part of the Australian story. Or he dealt with North America, which at one time was quite isolated until the Bering Strait passage opened up and animals, and including us, could stream in across through the Arctic. But those were really sort of capsules. They were much more continuous entities than Europe. Europe has always been something of a crossroads, something of a patchwork. So during the process of this tectonic shoving, there were times when there were lots of scattered islands, and there were other times when Europe was much more coherent.
And when there are scattered islands, you have an animal who lives on an island, perhaps safely because of the habitat, and then that island gets crumpled into a larger landmass and other animals live there, and that might drive evolution or it might drive extinction.
That's absolutely precisely put. I mean, there's an example I love, which he talks about, is what is currently the peninsula of Gargano, which is, you know, the heely bit of Italy. And the heel used to be very far removed from the boot. One could almost call it a microcontinent. And there were things stranded on it, which means you get this wonderful spectacle of the giant hedgehog of Gargano, which grew very big.
That's why I'm smiling so much.
Have you heard of the giant hedgehog of Gargano?
That's why I'm smiling so much, because as I was reading your piece, and I'm too embarrassed to show you the print-off that I have here, but I just went through underlining all of these fantastic-sounding animals, and when I got to the Gargano part, I was just like, enormous hedgehog.
The giant hedgehog.
And the largest owl ever known to have existed.
Huge owl, yes. Because on islands, normal evolutionary rules are, in a sense, suspended. Strange things happen. One of the things that happen is that things get very big, like the hedgehog, or I think there's a giant vole somewhere, which particularly amuses me. The other thing that happens is that things get very small. The elephant family, which, as you know, at one time had a global distribution, at one time went onto Gargano and other Mediterranean islands, including Crete, And there was one there that became smaller and smaller till, well, it says it was as small as a large dog.
And did that have they discovered the skull and they thought it was, that's the kind of the foundation for the myth of the Cyclops.
That is what, at least one popular explanation is.
I like that.
That the early mariners would come across the skulls of these things, they probably would. They'd see where the trunk goes in, there's a great cavity.
Ah.
So what else could it be but a very, very large median eye, a cyclops.
It's like that story, though, that people felt that manatees were mermaids. And then the sailors were. And then when you see a manatee, you think you'd have to be on a boat for a very, very long time before you could start confusing
or
a manatee.
Or in the fog.
Yeah, yeah.
That's slightly plausible. The Gargano Peninsula eventually married the boot of Italy, the whole boot of Italy, of course, swung round to its present position from a different position as the Mediterranean was squeezed and twisted.
It's almost impossible to picture this, isn't it?
What you've got to get a hold of is the vastness of geological time. And we're only talking here, we're not talking about deep history.
Deep history?
I work on things that say, scientifically, that are more than 300 million years old.
Yeah.
So for me, this is all the overburden.
Just the other day.
But very dramatic things happened, particularly around the Mediterranean. Most people probably don't know that there was a time when the Straits of Gibraltar were sealed off. And then the Mediterranean became effectively a giant evaporating basin, which meant that water came off and the salts got stronger and stronger and then started to crystallise out.
And what's the effect of that?
You put a borehole down under the Mediterranean Sea, you come across huge salt layers with rarer minerals too, but mostly salt, for the so-called Mycenaean salinity crisis. And Flannery describes what must have happened at the breaching of the Strait of Gibraltar, the sea pouring in, probably over a few thousand years, as the greatest waterfall, I guess, the world has ever seen.
Incredible.
And there was another one, reason I mentioned the Dardanelles briefly, was that a similar thing was supposed to have happened to the Black Sea.
And that would have affected as it got more salty, that would affect what animals survive and how they adapt.
Absolutely it would, and of course it also served as another isolating mechanism, so that strange animals could evolve on other Mediterranean islands, Malta and so on. It's a shame. I mean, I say, I think in my review somewhere, what a pity just one of these didn't survive. Wouldn't
absolutely
it be great to go and pet an elephant, you know?
It would. And it could have survived if the island had could maintain it. Is that possible?
It's an interesting idea, this, particularly in the context of the extinctions we worry about at the moment. Mm. I mean, it is worth saying that extinction has always happened. These interesting animals on islands, what was the old Dad's Army phrase, we're all doomed.
Yeah.
They were, in a sense, going to be doomed
once
they'd made a connection with the mainland. There are very few examples. I was trawling my mind to think if I could think of one, where an organism's evolved on a small island, has gone on to the mainland, as it were, and conquered all.
It's because they're almost sheltered in an island and then...
Yeah, they've evolved in isolation. Some classic examples are still with us. For example, on Mallorca, there is a toad, a midwife toad. Its relatives in Spain and so on are very unpleasantly poisonous. But it's a metabolic cost to make poison. So if you don't have to do it, you lose the capacity. So you become a very edible snack when the first snake moves in, as opposed to your relatives, which still taste very nasty.
So it's evolved away from the poison.
Well, currently we have, it's not Europe, and off the subject really, but we have huge numbers of endemic species in Hawaii. That's a thing that was seeded, popping up in the middle of the ocean. Most of those are probably long-term destined for extinction.
Nothing to do with mankind?
Well, it is, because we brought our own species there.
And the
flightless birds have been done in by the rats that we brought, and the things that weren't done in by that were brought in by the mongoose we brought in to kill the rats. So, yes, we have a lot of responsibility.
So
it comes going to happen.
Well, we should mention human beings then. So Europe was a battlefield, if that's not too strong a phrase, between Homo sapiens and Neanderthal man.
Yes, very interesting. This story is always changing. I'm old enough to remember when Neanderthal man was just regarded as a sort of cold climate race of human beings. Can't be said enough that the Neanderthals' brains were as big or even bigger than ours.
Yeah.
So they were not stupid.
And there was some interbreeding.
And now we know, thanks to the wonders of modern DNA technology, that we exchanged genes with Neanderthals. Flannery, I think, opts for the line that what Homo sapiens got from Homo neanderthalensis was some ability to cope with climatic extremes and perhaps dietary constraints and so on, that the Neanderthals had had hundreds of thousands of years to perfect. To put it terribly teleologically, we said thank you very much and then proceeded to exterminate them.
And is that known? Is that known that there was a sort of... I mean, is it wrong to think about these things in terms of genocide or...?
Yeah, it's... I don't think... And certainly he doesn't report it. There's such a thing as, you know, a Bosnian mass grave. It's much more likely that as the climate ameliorated, the Neanderthals really were adapted to a particular mode of life that became rarer. And the rather more adaptive Homo sapiens had a richer range of tools and procedures and so on. It took some time. And the two species, if that's what they are, were shuffling along quite happily side by side for a long time.
That's so interesting.
Oh, and then, of course, we have some jokers in the pack. We always think, anthropologists are guilty as this of anybody, we always think we know it all, and then 3 weeks later, a new fossil is discovered which throws it all back into the melting pot. The particular one this time being the Denisovians, which have a very, very different genome, which are known from, I think, one cave in the
Far
East.
So what were they?
They were hominids, humans, yeah. Quite closely related to us, and... It's been shown that at least the Aboriginals, Australian Aboriginals, have quite a dash of Denisovian in their genome as well. So, but we know all we know from the Denisovian is one, I think it's one limb bone and a tooth. But the DNA is extraordinarily well preserved. It's in a very, very dry cave. So the genome of this tiny, poorly known human is actually known much more than the body.
Tiny in stature?
No,
or tiny as in there aren't very many of them? Oh, tiny remains.
Tiny remains, a tooth and a bone.
You're thinking of the little elephant of Cyprus, yeah.
The little elephant, or the little hobbit, of course, of the little man, Homo floresiensis, that was found on one of the Indonesian islands.
Is there a story, there's a narrative, that wherever Homo sapiens is, there's always destruction and... There is always an incompatibility with others and a bringing about of a dominance of a landscape that is ultimately deleterious to that landscape.
Yes.
Is that the narrative?
I was going to say, I think I know the answer to
that. Well, no, I mean, you put it very well. There's been a long debate, certainly running back more than 20 years, of, you might say, climate versus humans. Were the extinctions of the so-called megafauna, many of which Flannery documents here, elephant species, cave lions and so on, was that the result of... climate change, or was it Homo sapiens ourselves, the modern form, coming in with sophisticated tools and basically finishing them off?
And what do you think?
He is very much, I think, a human culprit champion. I would think, this sounds very SDP, but I would think if you had a climate change which reduced a population of a megafauna, then they would be more vulnerable to extinction.
Yeah. Mm.
And humans, being smarty pants, would probably... butcher the last one quite happily and eat it.
And of course the tragedy now is that we caused the climate change, so as then that would have been...
Well, now we're bringing it full circle, because the one habitat that really survived with all the megafauna in Africa is now one that's very, very much beginning to be under threat. I mean, you look around the world, you say, where can we go and it's pristine? There are very few places, some parts of Amazonia and the Congo and Africa particularly.
And that's it.
Almost everywhere else. I mean, including Australia, if Flannery's right about the burning that early Homo sapiens did when he got there.
I saw a show about an uninhabited desert island in the Pacific. No one lived there, no one had ever lived there, and they landed on it, and the beach was just filled with plastic.
Mm. Oh, yeah, the plastic is the latest thing we've done, really.
Yeah.
Mm. I'm glad to say it does seem to have suddenly become a very popular issue.
So are you optimistic then? We should probably have to finish there, sadly, but you look at things from a proper sense of geological perspective, deep time. Are you...
Am I optimistic about the humans, about human survival, or climate change, or what?
Human survival within an environment that is not going to be destroyed by the humans.
Well, what is the elephant in the room in all of these discussions? It's the numbers of humans.
Yeah.
It's still not talked about. I don't know of any political party, certainly in Europe... that has population control as an important item. And I think while human numbers increase, then the demands on the environment won't slacken off. And we'll finish up, if we're lucky, with magnificent wild species in kind of extended game parks, with a population way times lower than it would be in a state of nature. But you can't have it always. You can't have these vast numbers of humans and a fully functioning wild ecosystem involving megafauna.
Which is kind of depressing.
Well, I mean, even in the UK, it's not that long ago that we had cave lions and hyenas and a much more varied fauna.
Yeah. Didn't the last wolf die out here in the 1600s?
Oh yeah, this goes into history. We're not just talking prehistory here. The ancestor of the modern cow, I'm sure that Flannery goes into this, is the aurochs.
Yeah, in Poland, they.
The last few were in Poland, in a very unpronounceable area. They would have been Shakespeare, had he had a wish, could have gone to see the last aurochs, but it would have been the last.
Well, and then the Nazis tried to bring them back, didn't they?
The Nazis tried it by traditional breeding, and they produced quite a good simulacrum of the aurochs. The only problem is it was half size.
It's becoming the theme of this, though. The size of a small elephant.
I think now there's, and more perhaps more possible, would be using a DNA technique on if they've got well-preserved aurochs DNA, which they probably have somewhere in bones and skins and so on, and they might just be able to produce a surrogate mum.
Well, we're heading into tabloid territory here, because I do remember seeing a news splash a few years ago about an American farmer who had Nazi cows. And there was this photo of these massive, muscular, angry cows. They were massive, they weren't
There's
tiny.
Nothing worse than a Nazi cow. We should leave it there.
We've gone disastrously off topic.
Yeah. Richard Forty, what a great pleasure it is to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming in.
These days, billing someone as the Italian Rider Haggard might not be a surefire way to secure for them a wide new readership. But in the case of the late 19th century writer Emilio Salgari, there's no getting around the comparison. Readers of his many adventure romances, in his relatively brief life he produced some 200 works, among them 80 novels, can expect whirlwinds of intrigue and exploit set in exotic lands to rival those of Haggard. The books are teeming with rebels, pirates, and princes generally chasing love, vengeance, or more often than not, both. In Italy, of course, he needs no If You Like This style introduction. In terms of book sales, he's thought to be up there with Dante, which is definitely not to say that his legacy is unproblematic. But if you're already clearing a spot somewhere alongside Jules Verne, you'll be disappointed to hear that very few of Salgari's novels have been translated into English. Might A Vast New Life of Salgari by Anne Lawson Lucas, reviewed for us this week by David Roby, be about to change that? Should it? Here to help us decide is David Roby.
Hi.
Hello. Before we work back to Salgari's own time, perhaps you could give us a sense of his place in contemporary Italian culture. I'm pretty sure I remember getting versions of his stories as comics from the newsagent when I was growing up. Is he still popular?
I don't think so much now, although it's quite interesting to see that you still have to pay to read his books on Kindle, which is a sign that he's still fairly buyable. So people are still prepared to pay to read him, but I think it is a kind of generational thing. The person who was a great enthusiast for Salgari was Umberto Eco, who wrote about reading him when he was young. Eco was at school in the 40s. And he said in the 40s that they all absolutely loved Salgari, which is interesting because he is in many ways quite antiquated.
Is he unsophisticated? Because the comparison that you give of Rider Haggard takes us down the road of sort of Conan Doyle, Lost World. Is he kind of unsophisticated and straightforward? Because even Thea's little Precy there, it sounds very straightforward and unreflective.
It is. In many ways, it's not as good as Conan Doyle and Rider Haggard. Both of them are very good on the local colour. It's all very well documented. In Salgari's case, he wrote about practically every quarter of the globe and had never been anywhere. He never actually left northern Italy.
Yeah, the furthest he went was a train to somewhere only about an hour away or something, and then he went straight back home.
He made it as far as Genoa. And he also allowed people to believe that he was a sea captain. He'd been a sea cadet, but I don't think he even went to sea then.
There was a case, wasn't there? Because he published his Capitan Salgari, as you said, and he was sort of ridiculed for it at the time, wasn't he?
I think at the time they bought it, but I think after his death people started to ask questions about it. He never actually himself claimed the title, but he allowed other people to call him captain.
The initial temptation, though, I mean, it might be to focus more on the work than because it's so colourful and fun than on the life itself. But what do we learn from this? Because it's a huge undertaking. I think this is only a couple of the volumes, but there are two
it's
more to come.
Four volumes, yes. it centers very much on the publication history and the reception of Salgari, really because there isn't all that much to say about his life. There isn't much documentation about his life. The suspicions of alcoholism and gambling addiction. He had a hard time with a wife who had psychiatric problems. And eventually he spectacularly committed suicide by harakiri. But on the whole, there isn't very much evidence about his life because he didn't really do very much other than write. In fact, he wrote so much he probably didn't have time to do anything very much else.
It's one of the great issues with writers' biographies, isn't it? Because often being a writer means sitting by yourself at a desk. So why do this in four volumes? Is there a demand for this to go into this level of detail about this life?
Well, I think there must be a demand because it is published by an extremely reputable Italian publisher, Olschi, and it's the most magnificent set of volumes with fantastic illustrations. And I think the justification really is that Salgari is such an important part of Italian cultural history from the late 19th century onwards and well into the middle of the 20th century, as Umberto Eco testifies. And that, of course, is what justifies the focus on his reception rather than on his life.
And why is that? Why is he so culturally central?
Well, there wasn't a lot in the way of competition, I think. Italians had quite a lot of trouble writing popular literature, and that actually shows itself in many ways in Salgari's way of writing, which is really surprisingly literary, very hyperbolic, and quite antiquated in its style. But that was the way an awful lot of Italian, even popular literature, was until around the middle of the 20th century. But also I think because the things that in a way seem to be his failing, the hyperbole, the rhetoric, the rather literary style, were things that probably attracted Italian readers. And he does fit into a sort of national agenda for cultural renewal.
And this becomes obviously particularly interesting once we get to the fascist period, and that gets its own volume in this story.
And that's interesting because I think it is a whole strand of cultural history under fascism that's brought out here. I think that's probably the main interest of the volume.
Did the fascists like him? Was he offering a national narrative that got fascist critics excited?
He's answering a national narrative that goes back a bit further, that really came to the fore under fascism, which is the need for a sort of moral renewal of the Italian people after unification to make up for all the centuries of decline. And there was a strong feeling from unification onwards, first of all, that unification wasn't going tremendously well because a lot of Italians didn't particularly like being unified, and that as a result they really needed to develop more civic and also military qualities which they had lacked then in the past. Salgari is writing at a time when people are thinking very much in terms of Italians needing to prove themselves on the international stage, which very interestingly then leads up to a very strong interventionist program for Italy to go into the First World War, simply because it would be good for Italians to learn to shed blood. And then, of course, then continued under fascism, with fascism also wanting to morally renew the civic qualities of the Italian people. So he answers to that agenda in quite a big way, although he himself was not particularly right-wing.
Well, indeed. So he was really, I mean, and we should say he was dead by the time fascism came on the scene, really. But he was at odds with the regime in that, especially in terms of colonial expansion, because his politics and his books are, you know, they're not like Rider Haggard. They're different. He clearly had a message against colonialism.
Yes, I think that's a good comparison because, I mean, Rider Haggard is a great poet of colonialism, isn't he?
Yeah.
And Salgari was not, and Salgari indeed writes about the underdogs of colonialism, the two main cycles being about pirate families. A lot of resentment against the British, for instance.
Well, Sandokan, the pirate prince, he was a prince turned pirate, wasn't he? And he, his family was murdered by the British, and that was his vengeance was directed at the British Empire.
The British are very unfavourably portrayed.
Wow. Thank goodness that doesn't happen now in popular culture.
He never found critical success, did he? He still hasn't. Do we know in his own lifetime whether this frustrated him, or is there any kind of movement to recognise him critically, or is it very much just as a product of his time as a kind of a pulp figure?
I think the latter, really. I mean, the whole thing is exacerbated in the case of Italy by the fact that literature tended to be something of a elevated and closed world, right, really, throughout the fascist period and into the post-war. Italians always actually were rather dubious about the novel as a, as an art form until the middle of the 20th century.
Really?
Privileged poetry above all else. Well, I had a hard time taking off in Italy, partly because of the language problem, that people didn't speak Italian, people spoke dialect. And so representing everyday life in Italian was quite difficult because you had to draw on a language was really a literary one, not a language of everyday usage.
Well, who is an early canonical novelist then for Italy? Who's sort of, I don't want to sort of say...
Well, the most famous Italian novelist of the 19th century was Manzoni, the Promessi Sposi, the Betrothed, which is in many ways an extremely good novel set in the 17th century. But it does rather illustrate the point that I've made, that it is written in a very elevated literary style that goes back for centuries. Manzoni struggled all his life to find the right language to narrate everyday events in. And never really managed to escape from the limitations of the literary language. It was only at the end of the 19th century that people began to try and write in a language that's closer to that of everyday life.
I find these pieces like this, David, fascinating, because if you're not from Italy, it's very easy to be completely unfamiliar with a country's canon. You know, there's occasionally writers who burst out globally and then become part of the global canon with whom everyone's familiar. But there are these figures like Salgari who, presumably everyone in Italy, if I was walking down the street of Rome and bumped into someone and said Emilio Salgari, people would know who I was talking about. And yet if I did the same thing in London, no one would have a clue.
That's right, and maybe less nowadays in Italy, but if you've been walking down the street in Rome 30 years ago, that probably has applied. I do think that Rider Haggard and Conan Doyle do in many ways seem more modern than Salgari. Salgari is a bit of a period piece, and what's in a way interesting and surprising is that despite being such a period piece, people continue to read him.
He was slightly more modern, on a final point, in his defence. He was slightly more modern, perhaps, in his portrayal of women than the other writers.
Yes, his strong and resourceful, independent and, of course, always beautiful women characters.
I wonder, I mean, because this life that we're discussing by Anne Lawson Lucas, it's in Italian, obviously. I can't imagine it will be translated into English. And I mean, I can't imagine the works finding a translator into English now. Well, I mean, some of them already exist. But
you two, I mean, even now talking about this, I don't get a sense that I should, you know, if there was a translation of one of these books, I should go out and read it. Is that fair?
Well, I can imagine with a young reader, you know, the reader you describe yourself as having been when you were younger, Stig, maybe I could imagine getting into these kind of, you know, swashbuckling.
I love genre fiction. I mean, it's a good question. Is this a good example of historical genre fiction that is worth persevering with, or does it not quite hit that mark, do you think?
I think he's a peculiar case. You can certainly read Rider Haggard and Conan Doyle and John Buchan. That doesn't seem all that out of date, does it? Making due allowances. But Salgari, there's the antiquated character of the language and the very exaggerated rhetoric is something quite peculiar, I think, to Italy. And that's a real limitation. I think that's why I don't think he was ever translated into English. It would read rather oddly in English.
Mm.
Well, I'm really pleased to have spoken to you about this and to have read it, David, because it's a figure that I had impacted on me not one bit, and now I feel I know a little about him. David, thank you so much for explaining it all.
Can I just add one more thing, which is I haven't done a great job in defence of Salgari, but I think the thing is he is a very, very interesting cultural figure. I think it's a bit difficult to say, well, should I read him now? I think there are a lot of better things to read in Italian now, but in terms of cultural history, he's a very interesting figure.
Yeah, exactly, and that's fine.
And that's why this book is so important.
Yeah, that's it. David Roby, thank you very much indeed. It's a good distinction, that, isn't it, between Dumas and Conan Doyle? Because I would still, as you know, the type of reader that I am, I would still read them, but I shouldn't do this.
Well,
you want to defend it.
Well, no, I don't. It's not my genre, but I think exactly what what David Robey said there. He's so much a product. He's so kind of bound up with Italy and kind of the history of his reception is the history of Italy, and that's really interesting.
But if he's not fun to read, if he's writing these...
I think he is fun to read. I think I did... they weren't his comics, but yeah. They were comic adaptations of his novels, and I know I really enjoyed those, because you do when you're that age. You know, it's all the kind of the Treasure Island style...
I love that stuff.
...stuff, which was great fun.
Yeah, so it is fun.
It is fun. Yeah, I think it is fun. I mean, I should return to the books before I confirm that for sure, come back in a month's time. Don't know how I'll find them.
And do a thumbs up or thumbs down on Amelia.
Go ferreting through my mum and dad's garage and the old boxes that they've been trying to get me to clear out for the past 20 years.
Watch this space.
If you are a regular reader of the TLS, and you should be, I mention subscriptions so often on this programme. In fact, if you're not a subscriber, do Google subscriptions now and get involved. We'll all wait here while you do that. Anyway, now you are a regular reader of the TLS, you'll have noticed over the last couple of years the presence of Ella Barron, our cartoonist. I say cartoonist, but that doesn't seem to do justice to some of the elegant, complex and beautiful drawings she does for us. Last week, over a full page, she drew a history of dreams in literature, from Chaucer to Kafka, Shakespeare to Lewis Carroll. This week, she's drawn our European cover, a map of Europe rendered as a painter's palette, which is a detail from a cartoon she's also done inside called Red Lines. It shows Britannia, a woman who looks suspiciously like Theresa May, trying to draw a self-portrait and failing miserably. What could it mean? We thought we'd have a chat with Ella about her art ahead of an exhibition she's holding at Christie's in London next month. Ella, hello.
Hi.
Before we talk about this particular cover, we don't give you an easy time, do we?
It's a nice challenge.
It's
a way of putting it.
Yeah, but it's not an easy brief, because basically we say to you, sometimes we tell you we'd like this, but generally you have to come up with ideas that are a bit literary, a bit cultural, and you can turn them into a picture.
Yeah.
How do you approach that?
Well, I guess the worst way is to sit in front of a blank email the day when I'm meant to pitch and look hopeful.
Do you do that sometimes?
Well, I've hopefully not. But I think what really works is most of my ideas come from quotes or like things that I've read. And generally, whilst I'm drawing, I listen to things. So audiobooks or podcasts or talk shows or TED Talks. And like I can get through like 10 hours of audio in a day, like quite easily.
Really?
So then I'm just like filtering it for ideas that might work at the same time.
Do you have a commonplace book? So if
that's what
says,
I was about to ask, just constantly, are you constantly noting down?
Yeah, right. I add them to my notes, but they're not that frequent that I'm going to forget them. It's more like, yes, this will work for next week. So it's ideas that are, as you say, like topical, literary and intellectual, but that are either already visual or I can think of a visual metaphor for, and there aren't many of them.
So do you sometimes think, oh, God, I don't know what the hell to do.
Yes. but...
It works out in the end, doesn't it?
Do you then take yourself for a walk and...
The worst thing is to try and think about it. Like, when I have to think of an idea, it's not going to be as good as if you let sort of... just let ideas kind of float around, hopefully. Yeah. And that sounds terribly floaty. It's not. It's just, it's quite hard to chase something down, whereas it's much easier to think, to come across something and think that will really work.
Do you have a favourite that you've done where that's happened, where it's been the process has been a kind of
a nightmare?
Let's do a happy one and a nightmare. Best one, worst one.
Oh, well, very early on, I did one of somebody reading on the tube. It was kind of Old Man and the Sea themed, and there was kind of
the
Merlin just like spelled out of the. And that was literally, I couldn't think of an idea, and then I got on the tube and I was like, oh, let's do something. So sometimes that happens, like just going for a walk.
Why would that connect with Old Man and the Sea?
Because I thought, well, I don't know, just the escapism of being somewhere not underground, and I don't know,
And you get the huge movement of the Merlin, kind of, and the thrashing of the sea.
And maybe
that
goes with the train moving as well, but just in a different framework, maybe.
So is that a happy or nightmare?
Oh, I don't know, that's quite clear-cut polarising between happy and bad.
Yeah.
That was just an example of a process which turned out well.
Is there any that you found particularly hard to bring together?
Compositions, sometimes, because the thing is, with drawing for the paper, like there are hard lines which I can't change, which are the dimensions of the page, the frame that I'm given, which is, you know, 13 by 18 centimetres, and the time I have to do it in. So often there are compositions that will be just much more comfortable in a completely different space, and I have to somehow force them into this unnatural portrait thing. And I think in a way, it's actually thinking about it, most cartoons are landscape. And that actually gives you a different image, because you do, like a comic, you do progression horizontally where things develop. Whereas because mine have always been portrait, I have to do depth. It wasn't a deliberate choice, but if I look at my drawings, I can see that, like, I've learned how to tell a story like that way. It's less like a linear argument where things follow naturally. It's more like a complex,
it's more telescopic.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, let's talk about this week's cover, which is magnificent. It's for our European culture special to commemorate Brexit. March 29th, although Brexit might not
Independence
happen.
Independence Day.
Yeah, it's not actually going to happen, is it?
No.
Well, it's not going to happen on the 29th. Yeah. It will happen, I think, but it won't happen on the 29th.
Struggle
March.
Across.
Some sort of line. Mm. Tell us, where did that idea come from?
So it's, again, the visual metaphor thing. Like, if we're trying to think of something that is about cultural diversity or opportunities within Europe and sort of free flow of ideas, and the idea of, like, paint mixing seemed like a good way to represent that. That cover came from the cartoon. Actually, the cartoon came first in my mind.
So tell us about the cartoon.
So the cartoon was, I was thinking about, trying to think of, a visual metaphor for Brexit, which hasn't been done a million times in terms of breaking stars. And it was had an artistic cultural angle, which is what would work for the TLS. And so I thought about, like, drawing a self-portrait as, like, the idea of, like, us redefining, like, Britain redefining or redesigning or re-representing themselves, like, but themselves doing it. So that was the idea. And then I also thought about, like, you know, the phrase that keeps coming out, red lines, like Theresa May's red lines. And the thing about, so red lines, self-portraits and palettes all work within the same kind of extended metaphor almost of artistic drawing. Then I thought that becomes a cartoon, because when you have, like, the individual visual metaphors are the concepts, and then the composition is, like, how you make an argument or a point, so, like, how you arrange them on the page, how they interact with each other. And because those things can be put in the same kind of allegory framework of, like, Theresa May drawing something or Britannia drawing something, then it became a cartoon. But then that is a cartoon, not a cover, as you told me when I pitched it.
Well, so I have a very simplistic mentality, as you know.
Which is correct for a cover.
But so the idea was that so Ella sort of talked about this very complicated, rather useful idea. And then for a cover, we thought you could do a bit from it, which is the palette mixing, which is a very straightforward metaphor.
Yeah.
Because the problem with covers rather than cartoons can be dense and telescoped, as you say, but covers really have to just be...
Make a point sharp and quick.
One thing with a headline. You have to think about it in those terms, which is slightly different, isn't it? It's a slightly different discipline.
Yes. In a way, I quite like doing both. It was I think it worked really well, because, like, that's like a sort of snippet of it, and they perform in different ways. So you kind of wonder whose hands those might be, and you get a bit of backstory, which was quite nice.
Yeah,
so tell us about, you have an exhibition coming up at Christie's.
Yes.
And is that's going to be some of your TLS work, all of your TLS work, and other things?
So it's, a lot of it is TLS, because that's...
Because it's really good.
And it's mostly what I've done, because I haven't been working for very long. So, like, a lot of my...
And this takes you too long to do this, so you can't do anything else.
Well, it's a good thing. But then also I've done some work for The Guardian starting in my second year of university.
Because you are not old, are you, Ella?
No, I'm 23. So, yeah. So I started for The Guardian then, and then I did a project every year, every summer, for them. First one was about refugees, second one was about sort of looking at mental health, how you represent art, and then the most recent one was in collaboration with Maison Sans Frontières, and I went to Lebanon briefly and worked with their counsellors on sort of trauma counselling and counselling refugees who've been, like, victims of, like, sexual assault. And the idea was to draw things that would be sort of useful in their counselling sessions as kind of like therapeutic tools, but also just trying to unpack these issues for people to understand. So there's a kind of sort of mental health internal dilemmas, some of those drawings, and then there's yours as well.
And they came together, interestingly, on
Rebecca
a piece,
Watson's
which you commissioned,
piece.
Didn't you?
Yeah, Rebecca Watson's piece, all about, well, it was a review of the Germaine Greer polemic on rape and Roxane Gay's book, and there were a couple of other books on the topic of rape, essentially, and you created this absolutely stunning cover, which was no easy feat, given the sensitivity of the materials. And as you said, I remember you put it so well, you said how difficult it was to find images and visual metaphors that aren't hackneyed and offensive to someone. It's such a sensitive area.
It was interesting because cartoons and covers, like, I'd drawn a lot of complicated, messy drawings about this topic because it is the right way to, I think, draw about it, because it is multifaceted and complicated. But then, because, as you say, covers have to be clean and simple in some ways and clear-cut, trying to extract an idea that was that from the complications was an interesting challenge. But it was good to be able to bring the experience I had to that particular commission for me.
Tell us about literary dreams, dream diaries that you did. So we now sometimes, which I'm sure is a massive pain for you, do full page cartoons.
No, it's great. They like so much space.
Which is big. I mean, it's a lot of space. Just people know that you can get 1,800 words on a TLS page.
Yeah.
So it's a big old space for a cartoon. And the literary dreams is basically a series of references to dreams in literature, which are then illustrated, and you can guess them. I mean, there's Anna Karenina, there's Kafka's Metamorphoses, there's
Cheshire Cat,
Alice in Wonderland. What's the Shakespeare? Is it
Tempest. I was thinking Dreams, Midsummer Night's Dreams, yeah. But didn't do that.
You didn't do that one, yeah.
No, well, I like the globe that spins into the. Just went with that
so
one.
How do you go about? I mean, how do you draw something like this? Because it's very complicated, very intricate.
At the beginning, I was thinking like sort of dreams are episodic and fragmented, and you sort of bounce between different elements, and that very much suits a comic because you have different panels and you move between them. So that was sort of the idea that like they'd be different moments, but then I liked when they like twisted together or one image turned into another. So we've got the skull that turns into a kiss, which turns into the wine glass for the next thing, which like goes into Kathy. So like I wanted it to have some sense of like flow in a way, because in a dream you kind of like your one moment and then you're like the next, and I wanted that to come across. In terms of actually drawing it, well, that one I did actually do it in order, because like I've done another full page comic one and I did the separate panels and then I like put them all together, like I like composed it separately, but I wanted this one for it to work like on a macro and micro scale. So I wanted you to be able to like look at an individual picture and see an individual picture, but then it also I wanted the whole thing to fit together as like a whole composition. So I came up with like the sleeper in the middle who sort of ties it together because he's having all the dreams, and then I kind of liked the fact that at the end you get back to this kind of tiny image of the actual TLS page, because that's what almost that you could say like that inspired the dream. So it's kind of like the different levels,
or a nightmare.
No need for that, is there? Do you draw this in pen or are you drawing on a computer?
A bit of both, so sort of biro sketches to start, and then I draw with a stylus, which is like what I've done most of my life, really. People often ask like how much you think digital medium has like shaped your style, but like because most of my style was like born out of stylus, it's just like I can't really tell, like it feels really natural, mostly because I draw negatively. So like often I'll have a black canvas or have a black brush strokes, and then I'll like carve the white light out of it. So that's something that is really hard to do. You can't get clean, sharp lines like that in real life. Like, normally when you draw, you have a white page and you put black on it, because that's what works in real life. It's quite hard to put light on dark. But because digitals don't have that constraint, like, I'll make a black space, either a black canvas or I'll create a black shape. Like, if I draw a limb, I'll draw the limb in black and then I'll draw the white, I'll carve out the light on top of it.
That's interesting.
It's a bit weird. But I think maybe, like, some of my drawings, if they're dark, it's like, and they have the light comes across differently. Because
yeah, no,
I can
see you have a style. I mean,
definitely,
we know your style,
but not deliberately. That's how I draw things. It's not like I'm going to do my style now. It's just how it fits.
So tell us, when's the exhibition?
So it's 5th to 10th April, and then on the 8th at 6 to 8:30, I'm sort of there, and it's a bit of an open house evening, and you can hear me talk even more about my cartoons if you want to.
Are you looking forward to doing that aspect of it?
Yes, it'll be a nice challenge.
That's one way of saying it. And people can buy your stuff there?
They can, and online.
And online, and in fact, in the TLS shop shortly.
Yes.
We're going to start selling that.
Not exciting.
You know, capitalism. There you go. That's what we're all about. Ella Brand, thank you so much. That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to David Roby, Richard Forty and Ella Baron. Make sure you buy the paper, A Celebration of European Culture, this week of all weeks. Make a stand for shared cultural values. Deirdre, I remember actually, because I was here when Brexit happened, and I came in early, and you were one of the first people in.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
And you were in tears. It was all. I mean, it was this moment you were like, I can't really believe this is happening.
Yeah.
And it still hasn't happened.
Yeah.
So that's, I'm trying to cheer you up.
I think it will, though, enough to bring on the tears again.
Yeah. But next week, it's 100 years, we're staying in Europe actually, since the founding of Bauhaus. That means nothing to you, we'll try and explain it all. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.